Okay, well, let's get started. I've just turned on the recorder. This is our last class for this session, and so today we bid a fond farewell to space. Actually, that's not true. The idea here is that we are now we've made some steps towards activating a new vision, a new understanding of space. And you know, we've given it a number of weeks now, so I hope that's the case for you, that at least some of the time you're thinking in terms of the field in which you move, the field that you inhabit, the field that allows the appearance of objects, and also the interrelationship between the field and what shows up in the field, and also, to raise another line of inquiry, the relationship between the field of space and awareness, which really is very closely connected with the field. Really, awareness, one way of talking about that, I'm not sure we've said that, I've said that lately, is that awareness is really found in the field. It's not found in the self that shows up in the field. We talked about that last time, that in order for the self to show up, it has to turn into this kind of objective reality, which we then think of as myself or the person. That's not a very fruitful way to think. And so I hope in the next weeks, because we'll be taking a break now for 3 weeks, April 27th, I believe, is our next meeting where we'll be moving on to time. So I hope in that 3 weeks you really continue to explore the power, the, you know, what's made available in this way of seeing in which space is understood as a field. And I'll say something more about that at the end. I wanted to say one more practical thing. I'll be contacting many of you by email, but the general point here, the retreat is the 7th through the 11th of June, so May, June, so it's actually only 2 months away, exactly 2 months away. And we need to get some confirmation that people are coming. So I have a list that Kathleen prepared, and I'll be emailing people to raise that question with you one at a time. Okay, so this is our last session. We are continuing, and I think in a very interesting way, continuing to look at this question of space as a field. And actually, in the reading today, there's two moves which are appropriate for the last reading in the section. One is the relationship between fields in space and fields of knowledge. We'll say a little bit about that, not too much, but it is discussed in the reading for today. And the second is a preparation, really, for making the transition to time. And it turns out that this notion of transition itself is pretty important, and we'll be looking at that. So, okay, first topic, right at the beginning of the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space, has to do with perception, the act of perception. So the issues that are raised here don't initially talk about the field, but I'm going to make some connections, I hope, that help clarify that. So the chapter is actually called The Act of Perception, and the first words of the chapter are in the act of perception. So we're focused right there on the act of perception, and the particular example he's using to start with is the act of perception that culminates in the recognition, a red apple. And then he asks this question. He says, when we perceive a red apple, or when we recognize that what we're perceiving is a red apple, are we actually seeing the apple? And it seems to me the natural response, you know, not maybe if you are if you have studied Western philosophy or Buddhist philosophy, but the natural response would be, well, to say, of course, what I'm perceiving is a red apple. Why would it even be a question? And I think he actually says, yeah, he does in the next paragraph, he says, usually, you know, we just take it for granted. What the, don't try to make problems where there are none. When I see a red apple, I see a red apple. End of question. What other problems do you have on your mind that we can solve simply? But the point that is being made here is that when we see a red apple, we don't actually see, as he says, we don't see the redness of the apple. We don't see the physical contents, the water, the sugar, the organic substances. Why is that? Does it make sense to say that we don't see the apple when we see the apple? When we perceive the apple, maybe we should make that distinction. So when we perceive and we recognize that we're seeing a red apple, Rinpoche says we're not actually seeing the apple. And why is that? Well, the answer is that we see a world that has been identified, right? So there's actually two answers that we want to look at. But the first one is just this notion that what we see is a world that has been given labels. So we look at the apple and we see the apple, but what we're actually seeing is a label. And then if we look, you know, if we want to focus in some way at the roundness of the apple or the worm in the apple or the redness of the apple, then we focus on those. But we're always really seeing something that comes at the end of a process of recognition, which is why it's important that at the beginning here it says, you know, there's the act of perception culminates in the recognition of a red apple. So by the time I see the red apple, you know, the original light rays, I guess you could say, that have bounced off the apple and into my eye, all that has been processed. So thinking in terms now of the brain and the physiology of it, all that has been processed and all sorts of things have come into play besides just the light rays. And only when all that has happened can we actually say it's an apple. It's a red apple. So the very idea that something has an identity means that it's been labeled. So at page 369 at the very bottom, the text says that. It says, each item has its own specific description, which we must in some sense have in mind in order to determine the image, we'll get there in a moment, to determine the image of the object that it's not. Whatever has a distinctive character is assigned a label, a name that has been previously recorded. And let's follow that out a little bit. In the middle of the next page, page 370, he's talking about the impact of that, the non-simplicity of the act of perception. You know, our ordinary understanding is, yes, I see an apple, that's obvious. But he's pointing out that the apple, our identification of an object as apple involves assigning it a label, and that actually turns out to be a rather complicated thing. The label is based on language, and everybody agrees. So you can think about how children learn language, and in that sense, it's all very obvious, right? When a little child is learning to speak, and they see a dog, and they say, "Oh, a cat," you say, "No, that's a dog," and gradually they get the idea. That's a dog. It's not a cat. And only when they actually can look at it and identify it as a dog do we say that they see the dog. So that's really the kind of thing that Rinpoche is pointing to here. But then he goes on to make an additional point, which is that if the act of seeing depends on labeling, then what we see is really based, at least partly, on a kind of consensus, an agreed upon reality, right? It's only because everybody says that's a dog or that's an apple that we see the apple as an apple. And so even though it seems like a very simple thing to say there's the apple in front of us, I should have been able to hold up an apple here. This is the right point. So imagine that I'm holding up an apple right there. Okay. The red apple, we only can see it as a red apple because we're applying labels, and that means we only understand what appears before us, or we only perceive something based on agreement. And the difficulty, the reason that that matters, is that when we see the apple, if it turns out that what we're mostly seeing is the label, right, David says, it's an apple with fingers. See, you thought it was an apple. No, it's not an apple. We didn't agree. Well, I asked you to agree, but David was not willing to agree. Okay, so what we see then is largely a question of what's agreed upon. And the point that Rinpoche makes here is that what we normally think of as real and substantial and the notion of apple that we have depends on or corresponds with, I should say, the actual apple that is there on the table in front of us. Well, maybe, but it also corresponds a lot to the shared agreement which shows up in the label. So if it's true that what we're seeing is at least largely the label, then it makes sense to say, as Rinpoche says here, that maybe we don't really see the apple at all. We just see the label. So this is also on page 370, about 12 lines from the bottom. He says, the more truth is based on agreement, the less direct observation enters into it. When we all agree that the shape in front of us is an apple, we may not have actually seen the apple at all. So part of what that suggests is, in one way, you'd say, this is a real problem because we are trapped in a world of labels. And in fact, a lot of the time, what goes on in our experience is mostly seeing the labels. We don't see the thing itself. So an example that I'm sure some of you are familiar with, there's been a lot of psychological studies on this in the last 10, 20 years, it is a phenomenon that's called change blindness or inattentional blindness. The two are a little different, but they're very closely related. And the basic idea here is that we assign something a label and then we really stop seeing it. So there's a simple example. Some of you know about the most famous example is about the basketball game and the gorilla, but I'm not going to go into that. An easier example is one where students come in to take a test in the psychology department and someone behind the counter hands them a form and then they duck down behind the counter to get something else. And when they stand up, it's a different person. But most people don't notice. 75%, if I remember correctly, of people didn't notice that it was a different person who stood up from the one that they had just been talking to. And that's because they had just applied a label to that person, and kind of a boring label, I guess you could say, oh, the person who's handing me the form. And they stopped seeing. They stopped observing. So that's what happens. That's one aspect of the right realization that our perception is very much based on labeling. Now, you could say there's a second aspect to it, which is that if our reality is largely dependent on labels, it loses some of its hardness. You know, it's there's a certain sense in which you say, it's very hard to imagine how reality could be different from what we perceive it as being, because it's just so darn real. You know, you pound your fist on the table and there's something that resists you. You say, well, how could that possibly not be real? There's a famous story about someone who was told about an idealist understanding in philosophy, Bishop Berkeley's understanding, that the world is just an idea. The story is that he kicked a rock and he says, well, that's my refutation. That's how I show that's not true. You know, things are real. Don't give me problems. But if in fact things are labeled, if in fact that's what our experience fundamentally consists of, then a certain amount of flexibility enters into the picture. We're able to see things differently. We're able to experience reality differently, and we begin to suspect that if we experience reality differently, then reality actually is different, and that there's no leftover. It's not like there's our experience of reality and then the reality underneath, which is never affected by how we experience it. No, the very notion that there's a reality separate from our experiencing of it is also a label. So although it's kind of disturbing to say, well, we're not really in touch with reality, we're just trapped in our own labels that have been given to us by culture, it's also potentially somewhat liberating, and you know, we'll go more in that direction now. So the second approach that Rinpoche talks about here, well, actually, let me say one more thing before I go on to that. There's an important line which gets repeated at the end of this first chapter in KTS, where he talks about the image of the apple that forms in our minds. Right, it's based on certain information. This is the bottom of page 368, and he says, one way to understand what's happening there is at the very bottom of the page. He says there's a series of pre-programmed transitions that remind us of what it is that we're seeing. And then he uses simpler language at the top of the next page. He says we rely on previous concepts and labels to let us recognize the image of the object. And that's what I've been talking about, the concepts and the labels. But this term pre-programmed transitions is important. What's important about it, we'll be talking about transitions later, is this idea of pre-programmed. So that's what the labels are, that's what the concepts are. Something appears before us, and you could say light rays enter the brain, just simplify, through the retina. And immediately, so there are pre-programmed transitions. So you're kind of tempted to go into a physical explanation of what that's all about. So just keep that in mind. We'll go back to pre-programmed transitions in a little bit. So you might say, let's get away from the labels and just go to direct perception. And that's a very attractive option for a lot of people, and people who are interested in this kind of inquiry, or in particular people who are interested in meditation or certain kinds of physical disciplines. Kumye, many of you know, or Tai Chi or yoga. It's a very attractive alternative to say, well, let's strip away the labels and just go to the direct perception. It's actually a key point, I think, in the TSK vision, that doesn't really work. So we've probably talked about it before, but let me take a minute to talk about it again. The reason it doesn't work is because you can't strip away the labels that easily. What you really end up with if you go for direct perception is you can't say that it's just, you know, that's the underlying reality. Let's see what Rinpoche says, because he addresses this very, very directly on page 370. Let's see. He says, it would be too simple to say, this is the last full paragraph, it would be too simple to say that knowledge in its fullness will appear when we replace agreed-upon labels with direct perception. Direct perception in any ordinary sense will always be based on a particular viewpoint and location in space and time. It will yield an intrinsically limited image of the object rather than the object itself. Well, I think there's a lot presupposed. This is not the place that Rinpoche deals with this in detail. So here he's focusing on how whatever we see is limited by our particular positioning. But you could also say that underneath that, the whole notion that there's something out there to directly perceive is problematic. And we looked at that last week when we talked about objects and the subject as these constructs, which really undermine the possibility of knowledge, because we can only ever see the surface. This is what we talked about last week, and that relates to what's said here. So that's not the main focus here, but it's important, I think, it's important to keep it in mind in general for the TSK vision, because again and again and again, people tend to say, well, all we need to do is get rid of our ordinary confusing conceptions. We just need to stop engaging the world through labels and conceptions and thoughts and go to direct experience. And TSK, the vision, says, no, that's very problematic to think that that's going to work. You may not have made such a radical change. You think you have, but it turns out that you've just kind of shifted, you might say shifted the field, or the field of knowledge, to use a term we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. So that's not exactly that is not the approach that we want to take. What we want to talk about instead right now is, and this comes up actually in the first part of this chapter, I skipped over it before, is this idea that when we apply a label, we are actually making a surprising move, that by labeling something, we're actually saying that it's not everything else, right? So let's see where he talks about that. He says at the top of page 369, if we reflect on how such recognition, so recognizing this is an apple, if we reflect on how such recognition arises, we see that sensing comes to completion when we can distinguish an apple from what it is not. So the dog-cat example helps point us in that direction. He says an apple is an apple because it's not anything else. Conversely, everything else shares the characteristic of not being an apple, right? In this sense, when we see, I'm skipping a little, in this sense, what we see is the image of the object is more accurately the image of what the object is not. It is negation that describes and points out, determining what appears. So this model, which, by the way, is you will find something very similar if you go into some of the subtleties of Buddhist philosophy, but Rinpoche has always been very clear that he's not trying to make a point about, you know, the same things that are talked about in Buddhist philosophy. But I think it's one place where his training in Buddhist philosophy really leads him to go in a certain direction. So the direction here is that whatever we see is actually, or is perhaps better understood, or maybe we can just say is equally well understood as everything that it's not. So the apple is not an orange, and you could say, right, well, it's also not a spaceship, or you know, not the color blue, or so in theory, you could say the whole universe of possibilities is present in the appleness of the apple. Okay, Hayward raises a question here. He says, a chair is also furniture and also wood. Well, that's true. And that actually ties into what I was just about to say. In principle, you'd say, well, if the apple is best understood as everything that it's not, does that mean, you know, we have to think about icebergs and say the apple is not an iceberg or the apple is not a chair? I think the answer to that is no, because we are always involved in a particular field. And so we've talked about fields of, you know, we've talked about field in terms of space. Here in this chapter, there's a little discussion about fields of knowledge. And I think it's more helpful really right now to think in terms of fields of knowledge. So if you think about a chair, or let's go to cats and dogs. If a child is looking at an animal and says, that's a cat, and you say, no, it's a dog, what you're saying is, in effect, we're talking about the field of small four-legged animals or something like that, or maybe the field of quickly moving furry objects, or you know, the fields by nature are kind of flexible and hard to pin down. So when you're talking about a chair, you say, is that a chair? Oh, no, it turns out it's a table. I was wrong. Now you're looking at it within one possible field of understanding. But if you look at it, I guess you'd say that was in the field of furniture, right? But you might say instead, that's a chair. The reason I know it's a chair is, imagine that you're in some sort of a theater and the actors have been taking the form of furniture. They've been, you know, sort of bending their bodies around so that they look like pieces of furniture. And so you look out on the stage and you say, oh, is that that actor? And you say, no, it's a chair. It's a very different field. You see what I'm saying? Or again, with wood, maybe you're in the field of wood objects. You'd say some wood objects are this and some wood objects are that. Some of them are chairs. So I think you don't have to think about the range of all possibilities, which would not only be all physical objects, but you know, moods and thoughts and physical sensations, so many possibilities. I'm not sure how important that is, but I think it helps make the notion that what it means to be an apple is to not be whatever the chair is to not be everything else, because we can kind of narrow down the everything else. So Michael says, I'm unable to verify in my own experience that I know it's Jack talking because it's not Hayward, it's not a horse. Is it only in the construction of a table, say as a young child, that a label gets assigned based on the elimination of everything else we already know? Well, that's a good question. It seems to me that we learn about labels when we're little, and then more and more and more as we, once we're adults, we rely on the label. But we're still just, you know, the label sort of includes within it the notion, this is not everything else. So when you see Jack on the video camera, you're seeing the non-physiognomy, the non-appearance of Hayward and, for that matter, everybody else you think it could possibly be, everybody else in the field. That's what's being said here. And I agree that it's not an intuitive notion. There are, as I say, there's a whole book on this theory in Buddhist philosophy. If you're interested in it, I'll tell you offline, just contact me, because I don't think we need to go there right now. But I want to take it in a certain direction that or this particular point in a direction that I think ties in with what we've been working on, which is basically, of course, the field. So I want to say a little bit about how this ties into the field, and I've already said something because we've talked about, you know, the field of animals as the range of what's possible when we're trying to figure out if something is a dog, right, or something is a cat. The point of, or the way to make that connection that I think, you know, then helps us understand the significance for our own purposes, is that something like an apple is an apple because it arises within a field. And when we say that the apple is actually better understood as not everything that it's not, and notice that we're talking about the not-not, which we looked at a few weeks ago, right? This is, I think, if you reflect back, we can't really talk about that too much right now, but if you reflect back or look back at that discussion, then I think you start to see why this discussion of the not-not, and of course the not-not-not, and so on, why that relates to the question of field. So the point is that whatever we see is not whatever else is in the field. And the field is this range of possibilities. And so by understanding by understanding things that show up in the field as referring to the whole of the field, sort of inherently referring to it, then we realize that whatever shows up in the field really remains the field. You know, it becomes much more understandable, it seems to me, to say the apple is the is not what is in, is not everything else that is not an apple that's in the field. Did I say that right? Yeah, I think so. So what that's, it's related to the entire field. That's right. And it's related to the entire field as the negation of everything else that's in the field, or as the not. It's not really a negation in the sense of an arithmetic operation, but it's not everything else that's in the field. So when you look at any particular object, what you're looking at is the field. And you're seeing the not and the not-not together. And that's what gives you the experience. So each particular object is really embodies or engages the whole of the field. So it's not a question, you know, this is a very fundamental shift. And we've been talking about it and looking at it and exploring it. This is another way to explore it. It's a very fundamental shift because it means that, you know, last week we were talking about how objects are kind of black holes in a field. You know, once the object has been identified, it becomes unknowable in a sense. You know, all we know is the surface of the object, but we assume, or we have to assume, that there's some thing underneath. But this is a way of getting beyond that. This is a way, or beyond is not quite right. This is a way of understanding objects as just more manifestations of the field. And I suppose it goes in the direction of that line at the beginning of Time-Space Knowledge, where Rinpoche says, all that happens is that space is projecting space into space. Okay? So you could say, all that happens is that the field is manifesting in a particular configuration that gives you an object that you can focus on along with everything else that's in the field that is not the object. So there's a kind of an openness there. That's really the main point for this. You know, we're not trying to make some clever philosophical point here. I think Rinpoche is opening up here our commitment to objects by instead leading us back to the field and helping us to see that the object is the not of the field. Okay. So I remember a few weeks ago, David asked a question, which I answered after the session and in the one of the orientations. And I said, you know, it's important to be clear that not is not the same as is, even though that's true in mathematics. You know, if you negate a negation in mathematics, it's the same as affirming, I guess in logic generally. But here it's not at all, because, you know, to see the apple in a way that doesn't emphasize its appleness, but emphasizes the field within which it arises, opens it up, liberates it in some way. So Michael asks, so the fullest way to invoke an entire field is to set aside one small part in contrast to that entirety? Well, I'm not sure that's right. It depends partly what you mean by setting aside, because it's not as though, you know, we're not assuming here that you have to look at something and then conduct this kind of very artificial operation where you say, you know, you look at the apple and you say, well, I thought, you know, I knew that that was an apple, but in fact, I'm seeing now that it's what I'm really looking at is the knot of all the possible things within the field, which is maybe, and again, we're talking kind of about fields of knowledge here, which is maybe the field of all possible fruits or all possible edibles or all possible round objects. If you mean setting aside in that sense, you take this small part and you contrast it to the entirety, I think that's too strained and artificial. It's natural. I mean, it's the way, you know, if you were going in kind of a linear direction, you know, you say, well, I've got to figure this out. Here's how I do this. Then you might say, let's do it that way. But here I think the idea is more that you allow the field to be present. You allow the knot of what the object is to be present together with what the object is. So there's not the same commitment to the identity of the thing. You're not exactly setting it aside. You're just allowing for the openness or for the availability of the field within the within whatever it is that you're focused on. Yes. Right. Right. Okay. Good. Well, maybe I got too caught up in the what, you know, what you meant by set aside, but that's fine. That seems very, I mean, it's a great example actually, because you know, there used to be some show on television many years ago where it was called Name That Tune, where they'd play a few notes of a song or some musical piece, and you're supposed to be able to identify it. And of course, people really can do that. And it's, I think you could say, you know, it's because the whole of the musical piece is present in those notes, you know, not just in one note, but as soon as you have two, then you start to see a relationship, and that relationship really addresses the whole. So there are a couple of comments on that. Klaus says, the object I see is not real, but relative. Yeah, it is real, but its realness consists of its relationship to the field. I mean, it's not the real that we usually think. It's not the apple is not real because there's this underlying object somewhere. The apple is real as a manifestation of the field, and that manifestation is relative to everything that's in the field that the apple is not. So there's always a field, a kind of a field awareness in operation. And that's really, I think, where this notion is meant to take us. Hayward says, the object and all it is not appear together in time. Yes, they do. That's another good way of thinking about it, although you'd need to bring in Michael's example of the piece of music, you know. the object and all it is not can include something that's unfolding over time, like in a piece of music. So, okay, and David says, the field is a range of possibilities. Yes, I like that. Okay. The apple is related to the entire field as a negation of what the apple is not, as if, like rising out of the liquid medium of negation, a form of what is known from experience becomes the image of what I identify as the apple in front of me. The imprint of apple photographs through as a focal setting. Okay, I think that's a good characterization. I'm not going to try to comment on it. There was something. Oh, yeah. One thing that comment helps point out is that when we talk about the apple as embodying the field, we're bringing into the picture the whole process of labeling, right? We're not saying, oh, you know, get rid of all the labels. No, in fact, the field also embodies or also has within it all of the labels that we use to make sense out of the field. I mean, we wouldn't really have a field otherwise. Ken is tired of all this. He says, field awareness transcends most of what we're saying. Yeah, I think transcendence is a nice word to use there. Whatever we say, you know, whenever we try to get specific about this, it's true. We're going to, you know, get too specific. We're going to, you can't really talk field, you know. You can only talk specifics. But even there, if we have this field awareness in mind, this possibility in mind, then I think what we say takes on a richness. So one place that in the chapter, I want to say two things about that. And then I was going to do an exercise, but I can see we're not going to have time. And I want to say two things about that. One is when you understand the relationship between object and field in that way, then things become more open, more indeterminate, and more transitional. And let me just say that becomes a nice way of transitioning to the discussion of time, which is where we'll be going in a few weeks. So if you look at the end of this first chapter, this point is made quite clearly, where he says, he's talking about how you don't have a single true story. You know, we're talking now about fields of knowledge, but there's not really a distinction. I mean, the field of space that we've been investigating embodies, includes within it the knowing that operates within that field. So he says at the end of that last paragraph, the single true story can give way to multiple dimensionality. And that's a wonderful phrase that Rinpoche uses in other places as well. We ordinarily limit the dimensionality of what appears to us. So you could talk about space, ordinary space, as limited to its three dimensions. But of course, what's being talked about here is broader than that. There's so many different layers or dimensions to experience. And a field awareness, I'll use that term because it's helpful, is open to those dimensionalities. And the reason is because of what's said in this last sentence, a non-positioned, unbiased questioning. Now, it's a questioning in the sense that you are allowing the field to be what it is. You know, you have an object, you have a view, you have an understanding, you have an identity, you have a label, all of these things that take on a kind of concrete form. And questioning those means that you're allowing the field to pervade what's there. So that's the questioning. A non-positioned, unbiased questioning reveals reality in a very different light as previously recorded determinations and distinctions. That's all the labeling and the pre-programmed transitions we talked about at the beginning of the chapter. right? Previously recorded determinations and distinctions arising through the transitional operation of indeterminate fields of knowledge. So there are the couple of words there that are important, transitional and indeterminate. So what's being pointed to here is that if we have a field awareness, if that's what's, if we have learned or are open to exploring in a kind of second level spaced as field way, then reality becomes indeterminate and transitional. And that is what allows then for multiple dimensionality. So everything changes, you know, our usual understanding. People always ask, well, what is it that you get out of TSK, you know? And there's a kind of, it's always difficult to say because whatever you say is too limited. But this is pretty good. You know, this is saying everything opens into an indeterminate, always transitional and multiply dimensional way of being. And we are not stuck. You know, if you want to say what's the benefit of a new space awareness, it's that we're not stuck with whatever it is that we experience, because the field, which is always the range of everything that's possible within that field, is always there. So that's actually, let me point you toward a very brief but very helpful discussion of this that you might want to look at in Dynamics of Time and Space on page 55. There's a quote that's very similar to this one. So we're talking here in Knowledge of Time and Space, we're talking about the transitional operation of indeterminate fields of knowledge. And on page 55 of Dynamics, it talks about the transitional constructions of multidimensional appearance. So if you let those two formulations interpenetrate each other, then I think you get a bigger, better sense, you could say, of what we're doing. And let me say one more thing, and then we'll stop, except for a suggestion I want to make. And that is that I think that, or as I was thinking about this, I began to see a dimension to the practice of expanding and condensing. We did that a few weeks ago. I began to see a dimension to that practice that I'd never really thought of in quite the same way before. And so here it is. Any of you who have worked with that practice, either for yourself or perhaps have taught it to other people, I think we always discover that expanding is easy. People like to expand. You know, you take whatever it is. You take your situation, the object, the thought, and you expand it. And then condensing is difficult. People don't really understand what to do, and we're forever pointing out that, people who lead this are forever saying it's not contracting. It's not making it smaller. It's condensing it. But what does that actually mean, to condense it? Well, I said something like this a couple of weeks ago, but this became much more clear for me as in thinking this through. And that is, it seems to me that when you condense something, what you're doing is allowing the field to be present within the object. So you have an object, and if you condense it, it's like you're condensing the field back into the object. Now, the field stays the field, but you're bringing in this multidimensional richness in the object. That's what the condensing is. So you might want to experiment with that exercise with that thought in mind. I think it's helpful. Okay, so the fact that we've been talking about transitions, I think, helps make it clear that we've set ourselves up now so that we're ready to move more into temporality. The one way of thinking about that is that if you are if you're caught in objects, subjects and objects and their interactions with each other, things are very static. They're very frozen. And as a result, you haven't prepared yourself for the dynamic, the aliveness of time. But field awareness, where nothing is set up, where everything is indeterminate and everything is, you could say, a transitional construction, well, you can see that the time is built in. So the possibility is there. So, you know, all of the TSK books, except Knowledge of Time and Space, actually, start with space. And I think this, you could say that's one reason, because until we understand the kind of aliveness and richness and fullness and openness of space, it's not so easy to get to the dynamic, the transitions that come with the dynamic of time. So that's where we will be going. But there's a little break here for 3 weeks. And my suggestion is that I have suggested now that you work with the expanding and condensing exercise, seeing it in a way where you'd say, well, the expanding is a good preparation, but the condensing, that's where the multidimensionality of space, that's where that shows up, because you're inviting the field into your perception. That's one thing. The second thing I wanted to suggest is, if you find a good occasion, take a look at exercise 15 in the TSK book, the mountain retreat exercise or the big sky practice. I don't really mean take a look. I mean, see if you can do it. Spend some time on it. People sometimes do it just by visualizing sky. If you happen to live in some gloomy cellar and you never get out, or if it's just cloudy out. But if you can find a nice patch of sky somewhere, that would be good. If you read in the reading we did from Time Space Knowledge today, which we didn't really have a chance to talk about, though I tried to gesture towards it, the reading for last week was the reading right before exercise 15, and the reading for this week was the exercise was right after exercise 15. So it would be natural to see what happens if you work with exercise 15, the big sky practice. Okay, so we're done for today. Always interesting, and thank you for your comments, which I think were very illuminating and clarifying. So we'll take a little break now, and I will be in touch with people in the training program, certainly, over this three-week break, because I hope to use the break as a chance to kind of engage the program, give it more of the attention that it deserves. Okay, thank you, everybody. Thank you, John.